This is Angle of View. Today is July 29th, 2025. I'm Will Hatman. We're playing catch-up this week, by which I mean I will be stringing together short reviews of many recent movies that for one reason or another did not lend themselves to length. It was either this or take my chances with Smurfs, or with the newest iteration of the Fantastic Four movie that Hollywood attempts every 10 years, or with the reboot of I Know What You Did Last Summer, in which, according to the trailer, the killer with the hook and rain slicker returns to terrorize some new teenagers, and then one of the new teenagers tracks down Jennifer Love Hewitt to learn how to stop him, and Hewitt stares daggers at her and goes, "What did you do last summer?" That's the box office this week. What would you have done? Megan 2.0. Further adventures with Chucky meets the Terminator, but a girl. Actually, as sequels go, it calls T2 particularly well to mind, not because it is good, it is not, but because it makes the original film look all the more serious and thoughtful. The first Megan looks like a substantive drama compared to this bundle of featherweight hijinks. The welfare of a child was at stake in that one. This one is just a dumb caper made of plot contraptions and wisecracks, with nothing like the kind of directorial confidence and sense of fun that it takes to make a whole movie run on such things. Every character is a comedian, including the child from the first film, who is now just one of the adults. And the tone is exhaustingly irreverent, so it all carries a feeling of forced playtime, with nothing to care about and no sense of danger to be found anywhere. It also reverses the standard and reasonable values that the first movie's classic sci-fi spirit of caution gave rise to. Initially, it appears to be doing this just for shock plot twist reasons. Bet you weren't expecting one of the anti-AI characters to emerge as the big bad. But ultimately, the way the story sells this character's villainy, too arrogant to trust the technology and learn to coexist, bumper sticker, with it, is such transparent pro-Silicon Valley propaganda that it seems like writer-director Gerard Johnstone is auditioning for a spot at the vanguard of AI movie making. He belongs there. Bring Her Back. Bring Her Back, the new horror movie from the Australian Philippou brothers, who started as Raka Raka on YouTube and then made the possession thriller Talk to Me in 2023, is embarrassing on sight. So transparently contrived to make you go, "Oh wow, that's messed up," over and over again, that it makes the mediocre Talk to Me seem tender and incisive. It then becomes doubly embarrassing when you hear the Philippous talk in interviews about how proud they are to have written something with rich characters and real emotional weight, and then remember that the movie you saw was nothing but a set of supports for the progressive mangling of a little boy. That's what they think seriousness is. More violence, worse violence, with more innocent victims. You're better off just looking at the poster. It gives the same total feeling, but you can be done quicker. The Woman in the Yard, in which a black family recently rendered fatherless is tormented by a woman in the yard. Considering how obvious it is from the poster alone that the woman will somehow end up being the mom, and that it will all be an extended grief metaphor, it's surprisingly engaging, at least until the story goes caca-cuckoo in Act 3 and you start to feel a house of cards collapsing. The last 20 minutes are alternately confounding and didactic. It's the movie at its worst. It's called upon to tie things up, and it flails instead. But the first 20 are honestly very good. The family's newfound rawness and the crucial plot constraints are braided together and exposed as an organic whole, well-paced and with nothing over-explained. For instance, the leg injury that Ramona, the mother, sustained in the car crash that killed her husband is both a hindrance to her action and a constant reminder of her loss. The cast is first rate, not just Danielle Deadwyler as Ramona, but the kids, Peyton Jackson and Estella Cajija, are perfect, and the three unquestionably make a family. And Jaume Colet Serra's direction, which in the past has proven more than capable of being obtrusive and irritating, as it was in Carry On, is here rather invigorating, giving everything that extra push it needs. Cinematographer Pavel Pogorzelski earns his paycheck, too. There is a mechanism by which the woman can manipulate objects in the house by grabbing their shadows. And yes, this is overwrought, but it also looks really cool. Ash. There's nothing much original to this haunted spaceship story, but Flying Lotus does a nice job embroidering it, making beautiful swirling colors menacing and, less surprisingly, turning in a spooky, dreamy score. The survival horror video game vibes are off the charts. I've never seen a movie protagonist look more like a video game protagonist in my life than Aiza Gonzalez looks here. A fit young woman with high cheekbones and beautifully tousled dark hair, wearing a skin suit with a futuristic logo on it. But this is no real strike against it. It's just the aesthetic territory it's working in. The few screeching quick-cut jump scares are unnecessary, and the antagonistic wacky wall-walker organism has been done better before. But as many other details are effective and even amusing, like the medic robot that asks you to rate your experience after it does surgery on you. Vermilio. Vermilio from writer-director Maura Del Pero is pretty and austere, often to the point of aloofness. It is named after a real village in northern Italy, which in this story is shaken up by a family's oldest daughter becoming romantically entangled with a Sicilian deserter in the final year of World War II. But it lacks the pulse of real community life. Even the wedding celebration contains no jokes or rash behavior or sloppy eating. Isn't this supposed to be Italy? Near the end of the closing credits, the sound of a big bustling table fades in, as if to illustrate for you exactly what the film has been missing. It walks instead in the measured steps of art. The central crisis is well drawn, especially in the critical scene of discovery. Plus, the kids are very good little actors all throughout, and the lighting is lovely and muted in a way that gets the cold in your bones. But it yearns to be seen as a slice of life and doesn't realize it's too severe to instill this feeling. The End. The inequalities and injustices that doomed civilization are reenacted in the apocalypse bunker owned and populated by the rich oil family. And it's a musical. The 20-year-olds born post-collapse, played by 30-year-old actors, fall in love and indicate their reclamation of lost innocence by a courtship that involves farting. Through a biography project assigned to the son, the dad seeks to whitewash his legacy as a planet ruiner in strokes so broad and exaggerated that they recall low parody, only it's played completely straight. It's Michael Shannon as the dad, for God's sake. Mom, Tilda Swinton, is repressed and only feels grounded when decorating the walls. She cut off her family, and nobody knows why, but she feels bad about it, kind of. Her best friend lives with them, and she has secrets too. These characters are pure abstractions. They don't even have names. The cast list is literally mother, father, son, girl, friend. And what we get from them is all this manufactured drama, instead of anything about the actual event of the collapse and the mark it left on the people who survived it, or what this did to their child rearing, besides compel them to make themselves look good and blameless to their kids. Every performance is mannered by design. Joshua Oppenheimer directs it like stage stuff, but then sticks the camera in for close-ups, so everyone's exaggerated expression looks ridiculous. George McKay, whose performance as Son is actually the only completely bad one, looks like an angry pony pretty much the whole time. And it's a musical, and it's anybody's guess why. The characters' emotions are so roughly sketched that you can't attach them to the kind of passion one just has to sing about. The songs are a hair better than the tuneless mire one typically gets in an original 21st century movie musical, but even the tunes that lock into a good melody and rhythm in their opening verse forget to have a chorus. And speaking of rhythm, the editing is disastrous. Almost every non-musical scene crumbles under cutting that demolishes actor chemistry and sometimes even produces direct continuity trouble, like someone's expression changing when we hit the reverse angle. The one brilliant thing in it is Mikhail Krichman's lighting, which is some of the most exceptional color digital work of recent years. He makes the ribbed corridors of that salt mine look like the Cremaster cycle. Sacramento. Sacramento, the first and hopefully last film from Michael Angarano, who even now will remain best known for playing the 11-year-old version of the main character in Almost Famous, is so energetically limp and lost that it's kind of fascinating. It's shaped like a comedy, but it's actually not anything. Pour one out for each of Michael Cera, Kristen Stewart, and Maya Erskine. They can't have gotten paid much, so hopefully they've got karmic rewards in store. Monkey Man. Dev Patel's directorial debut about a poor guy in an unnamed big city in India who dedicates his life to ruining the mob boss who killed his mother and burned his village. You've seen this revenge story 1,000 times, the colors faded long ago. and this telling sets itself apart only by the shamelessness with which it targets the weakest parts of your mind. All the beats are predictable, yet the dishonesty is suffocating. Every scene contains some choice so improbable or cheap or unconsidered that the producer's calculations show right through, whether the move is necessitated by the pathetic formula or drawn from the universal playbook for movie pandering. It's mostly defined by its whirling violence and screaming rage. But gee, for a movie desperate to be seen as brutal and nasty, it sure is happy to abandon this playbook whenever required to deal in more conventional and genteel pleasures, like when it gives us a stray dog that looks like it just scurried over from Westminster, or when it obliges our fondness for Patel's handsome face by refusing to ever, ever mess it up. He spends every evening getting his brains bashed in as a jobber in pit fights, and always shows up for his service job the next day without even a trace of swelling. It's hard to find a low point, but the extended flashback to our protagonist's life-defining trauma is possibly the most egregious and artless emotional manipulation I've ever been asked to endure in a movie. As with most of our benighted era's worst R-rated movies, it is emotionally inappropriate for children, but mentally inappropriate for adults. Patel is a likable screen presence, but his direction is truly awful, blatant, and incurious. He operates by fixing on what is already the most obvious plot detail and underlines it further, never taking an explorer's interest in the rich place in which he has set his story, and jazzing up the action scenes with an overbearing camera that just accentuates their narrative feebleness. 7 out of every 10 action movies are like this now, but this one is particularly galling. From the first, it is clear how stupid it thinks you are, and it makes you stupider as it goes along. Y2K. I was right in my prediction that Y2K would be bad, but wrong about the reason. I was expecting the problem to be the inch-deep costume party quality that always hangs over comedy set in the recent past, the 200 cigarettes effect. Make no mistake, this effect is fully in effect here. Half the jokes amount to nothing more than, remember this thing? And a good third of those were ADR'd in post. The epilogue, which is set in 2005 and lasts 3 minutes, contains ADR of a character out of nowhere asking another, did you take me out of your top eight? This kind of thing is like heroin to hack writers. Also, the protagonists are photocopied from Superbad, and the robot murder plot is lifted from a Futurama episode, and the idea of the robots fusing together bodily comes from Voltron. The only novelty promised is the chance to see 53-year-old Fred Durst play 29-year-old Fred Durst. But these kinds of shallowness are forgivable if a movie can use them as trampolines for takeoff into absurd fun. This one cannot, not even with Durst, and not even with Tim Heidecker, and it's because of how bad a director Kyle Mooney is. The reason it's bad isn't the cheap nostalgia, it's that there is no craft. The characters are ragdolls, no effort whatsoever having been made to give them definition. Not only do none of the comic payoffs hit like they should, but never is even the most basic narrative continuity achieved. A scene will begin with everyone in a completely different configuration than they were in at the end of the previous one, and it's not absurd, just lazy. I don't know how anyone is still falling prey to the fallacy that comedy is easy. Bob Trevino likes it. Bob Trevino Likes It is the most brain-dead piece of tearjerkery yet made on the exhausted theme of the found family. All of it is as believable as the idea that a 25-year-old in the present day, our main character, would be highly active on Facebook and would use hashtags and say YOLO, and that her phone would ding when she got a text. It's the story of an unlikely father-daughter bond between this 25-year-old and a 60-year-old, and it assumes the POV of the 25-year-old, but it was obviously written by the 60-year-old. Ghostlight. No kind of movie on this planet makes me madder than the quote-unquote intense, quote-unquote brave drama that announces it's going to take on the deepest, realest kinds of human pain and paints a great big fresco of Martian falsehoods. Every scene of Ghostlight, without exception, is pathetic, radiant with an emotional idiocy that's an insult to pain and every human who's ever been in it. Keith Kupferer, the lead actor, is plainly talented, and the one good thing about this movie's positive reception is that he will get more work. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.